Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered how women suffragists were able to rise up and advocate for women's rights in the midst of male domination that had existed for centuries? And have you ever wondered what you can do now to continue the dialogue? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, healing through love relationship mentor, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the book Love in the Blizzard of Life, a novel, and Love Lessons for Your Soul. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who just keep proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. April Young Bennett was communications director for Voices for Utah Children, advocating for changes to federal policies affecting children and parents. She was a founding organizer for the activist group Ordain Women, a group that collaborates with Catholic, Lutheran, Jewish, and the Parliament of World Religions, Women's Task Force, and other networks of religious feminists. April hosts the Religious Feminism podcast. She studied the lives of suffragists to inform her own activism, and we need people who are active like this. Her powerful book, Ask a Suffragist, is a must-read for all women of every age and for the men who love them. Her website is www.aprilyoungb.com. So today I'm delighted to welcome you, April Young Bennett.
Thank you. I am excited to be here.
Yes. So I would love to hear about your background. What takes a woman in this society to get so interested in suffragists and to study this and to be actively supporting women? So please tell about your training, background, education.
Sure. I actually became interested in suffragists. I wasn't originally a historian. I was originally an activist. So there was lots of causes that I really cared about. I cared about having healthcare access for all. I cared about improving the juvenile justice system, about everyone having access to education, and especially about women's issues, which overlap with virtually everything. We can't help children and families if we don't help women. And so I became very involved in feminism, and I became involved with lots of very passionate people that were working hard together, planning demonstrations, having protests, having meetings, getting the word out on social media. And it was all very exciting. But I started to realize that some of the things that I was doing kind of reminded me of things that had happened in history, things that had happened in the past. For example, there was one time when I marched with a large group of women, about 500 of us, to a male-only meeting hosted by our religious faith. And we asked for entry, and they said, no, you can't come in, but here's what you can do. We'll let you listen over the internet. And it reminded me of exactly the same thing that happened to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott when they tried to attend the World Anti-Slavery Convention. They said, no women allowed, but here's what we'll do. We'll let you listen in the balcony behind the curtain. And so I started to realize things hadn't changed as much as we thought. And there really is a lot we could learn from those who came before us. So I started studying suffragists, hoping to get some ideas that I could apply to my modern activism so I wouldn't have to keep recreating the wheel.
But what led you to becoming an activist?
I think that came from an innate desire for equality. One thing, I do have a very patriarchal religious faith where women are not equal. And this is something that I get asked all the time. I think that my religious leaders seem to think that feminism is like a disease that spreads from woman to woman. And they're like, who told you these things? Who got you interested in this? Who are you following? And I don't think it's like that. I think the need for equality is innate. And it's something that just springs up from inside you unexpectedly. And it's just natural. It's, of course, you want equality. When I first became involved, I started thinking about these concerns that I had. And I started kind of writing on my personal blog where I posted, you know, cute pictures of my kids and my pets, you know. I started writing essays about these concerns that I had, but then I didn't post them because I thought, nobody wants to read this. They go to my blog to, you know, read, to see cute pictures. And I just didn't know what to do with it at first. And then I found other people who were also interested in the same thing, and I finally said, okay, I'm going to share some of this. I'm going to share some of these thoughts I've been having privately, and I'm going to share some of these essays I've never published and put them out there. And that's when
I just have to say something, April.
Yes.
April, the sound is going in and out. So it's not always clear.
Okay.
So I don't know. So when it's clear, I don't know what you're doing differently, but be aware of that.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
So, yes.
Okay.
So
I will keep it like
what? Okay, so you just figure out, I guess. What can these women from our history teach us about what to do today or what's going on today?
Our technology has changed a lot, and so that's what I first thought when I was an activist. I thought there's not much we can learn from these women. Oh, sorry. At first, I thought there's not much we can learn from these women because everything has changed. Now we have the internet, we have TV, nothing's the same. But that's not really true because when it comes to activism, we have to build bridges, we have to make allies, we have to get people who don't agree with us to understand our point of view, and we have to find time from our personal lives to make all of this happen, and we have to deal with the setbacks and the disappointments. These are things that people have been dealing with for generations. We're not the first ones. And so there's a lot of things we can learn from them, from these people who started activist movements way back when feminism was new. And they were the first women to actually make their voices heard.
All right. So how do we as women make our voices heard?
One of the things that suffragists did is they came into spaces where they weren't welcome. They didn't wait for invitations. So there were certain things where they just wanted men only. They only wanted men to come, and they said so, and the women showed up anyway, and they kind of made their voices heard. And other times they formed their own women-only groups where they could band together and they could speak together as one voice in a big group, which was another way that they could make themselves heard when people were drowning out their individual voices. Another thing that they did, which I thought was kind of fun, there was one occasion where there was a big activist convention that they didn't want women to be too involved in. They're like, you can come, but we want you to be in the background. We're only going to have male speakers. And they called it the World Temperance Convention. And the women said, we're not going to put up with that. Your convention is actually a half-world temperance convention because you're only including women. And so they held their own competing event at the same time called the Whole World Temperance Convention to show that they could do just as well having a meeting which was inclusive.
And did they get a good turnout?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And they made the original organizers very upset and embarrassed that they had not included women.
Well,
because everyone noticed, right? Yes.
I have to tell you that I was part of something like that. I was the chair of a group in sexology for the sex therapy organization in New York. And I had a whole group of people with me, and we all submitted papers to present at the conference, and they were all rejected. So when we saw that all of us got rejected, we created our own little mini conference at the conference, and the organizers were very upset. But we got a good turnout, but the following year, all of us were on the program. So I had a taste of that. It wasn't for women's rights, but it was powerful.
Yeah, it gets people's attention when you do something like that that kind of highlights the inequity and the exclusion.
That was the point of it, to highlight that and to get your voice heard. So why is it still so important for women to get their voices heard?
Unfortunately, we're still not in an equal society. It's been almost 200 years since the 19th Amendment was passed, making most, not all, women in America have the right to vote. And yet we've never had a female president. We have more women in Congress than ever before. And yet it's only a quarter of the people in Congress are women, not half, even though we're half of the population. And so there's still quite a long way to go. There are so many professions where you'll find that the people who are in upper management are virtually all men. And so women aren't always at the table and people aren't hearing our voices. And we have to work a little bit harder to make ourselves heard.
And what I think many of us are noticing with all the female candidates for president, they somehow are not taken as seriously. It's even among women, it's hard to look at the women and say, yes, she's going to be the leader. Just speak about that.
Right. There's still a lot of implicit bias against women that you wouldn't think would exist at this time, but there's lots of evidence to show that it does. For a long time, we were encouraging women in the workplace to ask for promotions and raises because the assumption was the reason why there's this gender gap and women not being paid as well is because we're just being too shy and we're not being assertive the way men are in asking for raises. Well, more recent research shows that, yes, we are. We have got the message loud and clear, and we are asking for promotions and asking for raises, but our bosses are more likely to say no to us than they are to men because they see women differently than men. When a man asks for a raise, he's seen as assertive. When a woman asks for a raise, she's seen as complaining or whining. And so we really need to work hard to address those biases.
And what's interesting is even a female boss may respond that way.
Absolutely. It's not only males who have these biases against women. We ourselves hold those biases in many cases.
Because it's so ingrained in our culture for so long.
Right. It's really hard to find those things that
Hello? Did I lose you?
Yeah, sorry. I think that our signals are a little bit off, and I keep cutting you off, so I was just waiting. Sorry.
Okay, so just say what you were about to say.
Okay. Just because the way we are all raised is still stuck there in our brains, and so even if we have a desire to be equitable, we may not realize the implicit biases that are there.
That's absolutely true. We don't even realize. We just react, like look at women and their clothing or something that may not be so important about them. We focus on the wrong things. So you're doing something to help us be more aware. So what can women do now to really make a difference, to get the changes that we need?
One thing I love about studying the suffrage movement is I see how much these women paid it forward to each other. once one of them had crossed a milestone and had broken a bit of that glass ceiling, they would pull up other women with them and help them to get through that process. One example I can think of is Harriet Hunt. And Harriet Hunt was the first woman to apply to Harvard Medical School. They did not let her in because she was a woman. And she worked really hard to get in, didn't make it, but she already had a medical practice. At that time, you could get a medical practice in other ways through apprenticeship. And so it became her mission to help other women to get into medical school as she hadn't been able to. And she set up a scholarship fund for women to help women to go to medical schools. She became an activist and became involved in women's rights conventions where she talked about the need for women in the medical profession. And another woman as well, Elizabeth Blackwell, who was the first one to actually get into a medical school in America. After she graduated, she looked around and said, okay, now I've graduated and there are some other women who are being allowed to attend medical school now, but where will they work? Because the hospitals wouldn't hire them. And so she set up her own hospital so she could hire women.
Wow. And I thought of something that was done in the tennis world. I played tennis for years. Billie Jean King, many years ago, advocated for women to make equal pay to the men. I'm not sure what the pay is at this point, but she really fought for it and brought the other women along.
That's right. I love that when someone who excels in their profession then looks around and says, how can I help all the other women out here who are working towards this too?
Right. But it first takes, I guess, doing something and running into these barriers yourself. But not everybody who runs into barriers like that and succeeds, not everybody helps others. So that sounds like a big message that you're putting out, that women can help other women to
keep
this dialogue going.
And it doesn't just have to be women. Some of the first feminists were men, like William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass, who really did care about women and they cared about their causes. They were abolitionists and they wanted to abolish slavery, and they realized that men couldn't do it alone. They needed women to have their rights so that women could also help abolish slavery, so women could also help in the causes they believed in.
And you just reminded me of a wonderful Greek play, as you're talking about that, Lysistrata, where the women banded together and refused to have sex with their husbands to stop the war. Or with men in general, they just stopped. So
sometimes you have to go to creative methods.
Yeah, you have to be creative.
I just said sometimes you have to get creative.
But women can be very powerful when they band together.
Absolutely.
And another piece of that is the women banding together, but not only relying on women, but connecting with the men. So what can men do? How do men help or hinder the progress of the feminist movement?
With our society still not being equitable, lots of men are in places of privilege where we don't have women. Lots of men are seated at those tables where women aren't there yet. There are more men in Congress. There are more men in our state legislatures. And in many professions, there are more men who are serving in management positions. And unfortunately, that also means that more men have money. So there are many ways that men have privilege that they could use to benefit the feminist cause if they so chose. And there were many men who did choose to do this in history. I think of another example of someone named Dr. Schmidt, who was a doctor in Berlin. And his dream was that his replacement would be a woman. This was way back in the middle of the 1800s when women were not doctors. And he decided this was something that was important to him, and he was going to train up a woman to be his replacement. And he did, and that woman was Marie Zakrzewska. And he just basically helped her all along the way and mentored her
And he had to break some barriers. He even went to visit the King of Prussia to get her into medical school because they didn't want to admit her. And so he worked really hard to get, and we benefited from that in America, because after that she immigrated to the United States and became a doctor here, where she was involved in training many other women to be medical professionals.
Well, I know that Europe was ahead of America in terms of women doctors in the field of psychology and also in the medical field.
Yeah, we've been so blessed by our immigration culture here in the United States, because there's so many people who came from other countries and brought good ideas with them here. Another example, I think,
absolutely,
is Ernestine Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ernestine Rose, she was Polish. And when she was in Poland, she fought for her rights to maintain her property from her betrothed. She was betrothed to somebody, and he threatened to confiscate all of her property. And she took him to court, and she won. And then when she came to America, she still had that passion. Now she was married to a different person, and she liked him, but she didn't like that, according to American law, he owned all of her things. And so she was one of the very first people to start the movement in America for women to have property rights.
Wow. It's amazing how one person can get it started, because we just take it for granted now. No, I have to say, wait a second. I had a tax-deferred annuity at my college. I was a professor at a college. And I took the money out, and then I wanted to put the money back in. And they said that I needed my husband to sign it. And then
what?
They changed that a few years later. This was, I have to think of what years it might have been, maybe the early 1990s or late 1980s. Where they actually had
incredible.
A ruling that the husband had to sign. And women had problems with credit cards, too. I remember that. You know, now
law
has changed.
That's exactly what Ernestine Rose was fighting against almost 200 years ago.
Wow, but it was still going on. I remember I was shocked by that. Yeah. And it was in New York, which you thought was liberal, but... So,
and
is another question. We're having like a little time delay, so I'm sorry if I'm cutting you off, or it seems that way. Is it possible for women to break the glass ceiling? And if so, how do we do it?
It takes a lot of persistence. We still have a wage gap now, and the average American woman is making 80 cents to every dollar a man makes. And of course, women from certain places or from certain ethnicities and races are making even less. And so we're certainly not done. However, one nice thing about studying the suffrage movement is I can see how far we've come. And we really have made so much progress since that time. And we really have the women who came before us to thank for that. It takes a lot of persistence. Susan B. Anthony was one of the first women to address the wage gap. And the reason she did that is because she was forming all these activist groups. So these were groups of volunteers who were willing to work without pay for causes they believed in, like ending slavery and promoting temperance. And she was working with these women, and she'd find that after a little bit of time, their activist groups would completely dissolve because they had no funds to pay for the things they wanted to do. And she said, woman needs a purse of her own. And so she started fighting within her own profession. She was a teacher, so she joined the New York Teachers Association. And at her very first meeting, she started talking about how the association had many, many female teachers, more female teachers than male teachers, and yet all the association leadership was male. And so she started talking about how we need women in leadership. And she came back year after year, and people were getting really annoyed at the male people. They said, can't we just have a meeting about teaching without this eternal jangle about women's rights? And she didn't lay off. She kept going, and eventually that association was integrated, and women became leaders in the organization. And they were able to support other causes that Susan believed in.
And you seem to have been very involved with the religious communities. So tell us about that, what's going on and what you've done in that arena.
Absolutely. So I became involved in religious feminism almost a decade ago because I find that within our society, within religious communities, there's still a lot more inequity than you find elsewhere. Religious communities are exempt from many of the laws that require other organizations to be equitable. And there's a lot of tradition there that is hard to overcome. And so I think it's a really important area for women to address. And it spills over into other aspects of society because people learn to tolerate inequity in their communities of faith. And then they're okay with it when they go out into other places and might discriminate in the workplace, or they might go to the polls and refuse to vote for women because of the things that they've learned as they've grown up in these inequitable environments. And so this is something where lots of women from lots of different religions are working towards making a change. And we find that these issues that we have with patriarchy, even though our religious faiths are different from each other, and we may have different beliefs about theological issues, patriarchy pretty much works the same way in every community. And so there's a lot of ways that we can collaborate together to address these problems. When I look back at the past of the suffrage movement, there were a lot of women in the suffrage movement who banded together, who did not share common beliefs, but they did find that they could work together to fight patriarchy.
And have you seen any examples of religious groups that were equitable or are equitable?
Absolutely. There are a lot of religious communities that have made a lot of wonderful strides in this way. There are many communities where women are ordained to leadership roles in those faith communities and where they're supporting other women and trying to get more people involved in the clergy. And I think it's also important to remember that even for those who come from more patriarchal religious communities, it's often their religious faith that leads people into activism, because even if they come from a patriarchal religious community, they're learning about distinguishing between right and wrong. They're learning to care about social justice and about making the world a better place. And this leads many women to become activists.
Yeah, really good. And so another aspect is diversity. We talk a lot about diversity nowadays. How is that displayed and acknowledged in the suffragist movement and feminist movement?
The suffragist movement was made up of many multiracial people. There was a time period where we weren't learning as much about the history. Actually, when it comes to women's history, unfortunately, most of us don't know very much. And so maybe we've heard of Susan B. Anthony, but not very many other people. But there were many women of color who were very active in the suffragist movement, such as Sojourner Truth, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, the women of the Fortin Purvis family, Mary Ann Shad Carey. There were many women of color who made important contributions to this movement. However, there were also some times when they had to call out their white counterparts for racism, because there was a certain... Well, part of it is that these people were products of their own time, and so they learned the bad habits that was going on all around them in their communities. Part of it is that also there came a point in time where it almost seemed like Black men were competing against white women for rights. And they were saying, my rights are more important than yours, and vice versa. And whenever you start competing against other disadvantaged groups, instead of fighting the patriarchy directly, I think that you're in a bad cycle.
And I have another thought that I don't know if you've thought about this, but where did transgender people fit into the issue of feminism, women's rights?
Yeah, that when you look at the transgender issues, you see that gender isn't quite as static as we always thought. And so then it even makes less sense to have, say, certain roles for women and certain roles for men when there's so much crossover.
Right, and I know that, I'm sorry to interrupt again. There were people who are transgender and spoke about what it was like when they were a man and they were treated one way and then they became a woman and were treated another way and vice versa.
Right. Yeah, one person who was a suffragist, Julia Ward Howe, who thought about these issues a lot, it is kind of interesting. She kind of was thinking about this before she became an activist and before she kind of had figured out what she thought about things. And she was a novelist, and she wrote a novel about an intersex person and kind of explored her feelings about gender issues and the things that men were allowed to do and the things that men were allowed to do through this novel she wrote about a person who was intersex. And so it's really fascinating how she came into feminism that way.
Wow, that's really ahead of her time. Because most of us have never thought of these issues until recently.
Yeah, but she did not attempt to publish it. I think it was mostly she wrote this novel for herself so that she could explore these ideas in her own head.
Well, maybe she did attempt to publish it, but maybe nobody would publish it. That's another possibility.
Maybe.
Wow, so you really have done a thorough study of this. So is there anything else that you want to share about suffragists, about feminism, whatever?
I would just encourage people to look into our past. There's so much that we can replicate, that we can do again. Many of the same things that people have been doing for generations, like protests and demonstrations. The reason why we still do these things is because they work. And so it's wonderful to see how our foremothers did it and to replicate that. And like I said, they did make some mistakes, especially with regards to racism. So I think knowing our past helps us to avoid repeating ourselves and repeating those mistakes.
Absolutely. So now tell us how people can get your book and tell us the name of the book again and how they can get it and how they can contact you.
It's Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminists. And if you visit my website, askasuffragist.com, you can find links there to buy the book at your local bookstore or at Amazon or wherever good books are sold.
Wow. And you also have a website, aprilyoungbee.com. That's on the page.
That's right.
What can they find
yes.
there?
And if you go to aprilyoungbee.com, you can see my suffrage projects. You can also see my other projects, such as the Religious Feminism Podcast and the blogging I do as a Mormon feminist.
All right. So before we go, tell us about your podcast.
The Religious Feminism Podcast is a project I began after doing many years of Mormon feminism. And I wanted to meet other women who were working within their own religious communities and kind of share ideas and collaborate. And so that is a place where people of many different religious faiths and secular or feminist organizers can talk to each other and can share and can get ideas on how we can work together to make the world a more equitable place.
Well, April Young, it's really a delight to have you on the program. And you're doing so much good for women and for society. So I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to be here.
And yes, thank you. And to those of you listening, I do look forward to speaking to you again soon. Bye for now.